This is The Literary Life. I'm Mitchell Kaplan. I've owned Books and Books and been a bookseller for over 35 years. What you're about to hear are conversations about all things literary, with writers, readers, publishers, old friends, new friends, and anyone who might wander into our store with an interesting story to tell about their connection to books, reading, or writing. These will be informal, over the backyard fence kind of conversations, the kind I and booksellers everywhere have each and every day. So one of my favorite things to do in New York, when they did have a physical space, was to go into the Village and go into the Morrison Hotel, that great photo gallery.
Yeah, well, it's in Tribeca now.
Oh, they moved to Tribeca?
Yeah, I didn't realize. Yeah, it's up a flight of stairs, but Tribeca is grim for me.
Yeah, no,
I haven't. Soho even more so. They're in Soho,
Yeah, well, I didn't realize they had a physical space.
Yeah.
So I used to go in there, and this, for years, it would be one of the stops that I would go. And I would be admiring the work of Chris Stein each time I went in. And I didn't really even realize how much of his work I was admiring until I looked through his most recent book, which is called Point of View, Me, New York City, and the Punk Scene. All of you know that Chris is the co-founder and bassist guitarist of the band Blondie. He's also the producer and performer for the classic soundtrack of the hip-hop film Wild Style and writer of the soundtrack for the film Union City. Chris started taking photographs in 1968. During his last years at the School of Visual Arts in New York City, he began hanging around the early downtown rock scene, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, and taking rock portraits. Chris, welcome to The Literary Life.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here at the book fair. Tonight, we're presenting your cohort, Debbie Harry, with her autobiography, Face It. And this gives me just a great opportunity to talk to you about this other aspect of your work, which is the photographic aspect. How did you get started doing it?
I was always screwing around with little cameras when I was a kid, and brownie cameras, and taking pictures of toys. And there was a moment I took cameras into the spook rides in Coney Island, and that was a high point for me. And I wish I had some really great pictures of the creatures, things, whatever you want to call them, that were, afoot in the spook rides. I wish I could dig some of them out, but stuff gets lost. And then a little bit later, when I was involved in early aspects of the music scene and pop culture, I started hanging out with this kid in Brooklyn, Dennis McGuire, who was a really great photographer, and he was always on the periphery of the Warhol scene. He was a big inspiration. So that was about 68. And then I started seriously schlepping an actual camera around after that.
Talk about how your family had an influence on you.
My mom was a painter, so I grew up with an artistic bent, as it were. And she was great. I wish I had more of her stuff, but life is about loss. So much stuff gets lost,
But so you felt encouraged and you felt...
Yeah, she was always very supportive. And in later years, she was super supportive of the band situation.
So you spent most of your life in, not most, but you spent a lot of your life in Brooklyn. What then made you make that move to Manhattan?
It was just the allure of the city at the time. And I was always going back and forth when I was a kid. When I was 15, 16, 17, I would hang out on McDougal Street in that whole milieu. And sure. I jammed at the Night Owl. And, I used to see Hendrix wandering around, but I never saw him. I only ever saw him the one time at Woodstock. And Richie Havens was always out on the streets. And just that whole scene, folk coming out of the folk scene. I was a folkie also.
And as legend has it, your parents bought you your first guitar.
Yeah, parents bought me first, which was electric guitar, Harmony Rocket, which you can find on eBay for about $300, which probably only cost about 50 at the time.
And what was that first band that you were in like?
Was it like a high school band?
No, just
me and my buddies from the neighborhood. Yeah, some of them might have been from school. And, famously, we wound up opening up for the Velvet Underground. That was a little later in 1967.
Wow.
So it's another story.
Well, there's a lot of stories.
A lot of stories, yeah.
A lot of stories. But what I love about this book and what I love what you did is it's a book about everyday people, everyday life. It's a book about the commonality that we all felt in that New York of that time.
Yeah.
Wasn't it? It was such a different New York.
Yeah. Well, we have this kid driving us around, and he's just a kid, and he was, I'd like to go to New York. Is it crowded? And I was telling him, it's not, it was a lot less crowded than the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, certainly, than it is now.
Well, there was also a certain grittiness to it.
Yeah, all that stuff.
That you bring to it in a way that people today wouldn't recognize, right?
To a certain extent, they did a good job of portraying things in the Deuce TV show and saw that at all.
I remember in the 70s and early 70s, I had a cousin who was squatting in Union Square, in a building mm-hmm. around Union yeah. Square. And Union Square was filled with junkies and
yeah.
street people and all of that. And he was once quoted, when it started getting gentrified, he was once quoted as saying, I kind of liked it better when the drug dealers were all around.
Well, yeah. I liked Times Square much better with the junkies and hookers, for sure, than Elmo and all that crap. Yeah. And M&M's, it's appalling. But what are you going to do, I had in like 1965 or something, my friend's older sister had a apartment on the Lower East Side that cost $24 a month.
Right.
For, one room to the tub in the kitchen, people are kind of aghast at that nowadays.
So, we're about the same age. I'm probably just a couple years younger than you are. And I looked at you from Miami Beach, is where I grew up. And I couldn't imagine being where you were at the forefront of what was going on at the time. Explain what life was like a little bit like.
I was just really lucky that I've always had this kind of zealig position of being in the right place at the right time. I went to San Francisco in 67 and 68 in the summer, and I was at Woodstock, and Debbie was at Woodstock also, but we didn't know each other. So I was just always in this moment that was kind of in the fore, I guess. And then I just gravitated to the downtown music scene. I started seeing, media about it when I was in art school at Visual Arts. And I just fell into the whole environment, which was pretty small and limited and incestuous at the time.
Right. Well, there were the clubs that everybody hung out in.
Yeah. But it was Max's and Mercer Art Center
and CBGB.
CBGB was a little bit later, but
right.
Initially it was limited.
Well, I think Max's was the first one that I remember when I would go there.
Max's was going since the 60s.
Yeah. And one of the albums that I remember buying was live at, Velvet Underground live at Max's.
Yeah, yeah.
Great album.
Yeah.
You may be on it, if I'm not.
Somewhere.
Well,
me and my friends opened up for them at a place called the Gymnasium, uh-huh. which is, and they're recently, over the last few years, there's recordings of them there are available. Now they did like a residency at this old, Eastern European hall uptown.
Was it, and tell me, because I think it ties in with your photography, was it something unique about New York that allowed this music scene to develop there, of all places?
The incestuousness, partially, because everybody just fed off each other, and it was also very isolated. People don't appreciate that now because of the connectivity with the fucking media
right.
situation that we're in now. But it was really cut off from everything, so the whole thing got to ferment. onto itself. And there, you know, the Liverpool scene and San Francisco scene and all these, there were other similar moments, I think, you know.
Well, there was the ability to have an underground in a sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Where people could, it wasn't co-opted as quickly as it
is. No, it was, we were going for 4 or 5 years before we got any attention.
Right, right.
And the Dolls went out into the world and failed. So everybody figured, oh, okay, whatever. We're just going to stick to it. And there was no crazy ambition at that point. It was just.
But growing up as you did in the folk scene and going through as you did, as so many of us did, you know, the intensity of the 60s was, you know, and then the intense commercialization that happened in the music scene. Was there a consciousness, a conscious effort to sort of a big fuck you to all that, in a sense?
Well, there was just a musical backlash against all the what had really become MOR, you know, and people don't really use that middle of the road terminology anymore. But, you know, everything was dominated by this real musicality, and, you know, Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles and all this stuff was what was dominating the chart. So there was a conscious push against that stuff, I think.
Well, also, since we're at a book fair, there's also a very literary connection in your book of photographs.
Sorry about my
Twitter.
I like. Everybody should follow me on Twitter, though.
What is your Twitter handle?
It's there? Just my Christine Plays, but it's easy to find.
Are your photographs on Instagram as well?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I have more Instagram followers than Twitter followers.
Oh, that's great.
Twitter is reserved for complaining about politics mostly. At this point.
Well, that's we're in that night right now. I'm surprised anyone's on the street given what's going on now.
Yeah, well.
But I know there are two things that struck me about the book. You know, clearly, you know, there's Andy Warhol, there's all these others, but I love the photograph of Lester Bangs.
That's one of
on Coney Island.
Well, I gave a big print of this to Jon Stewart and he got really excited and he said, "Oh, my father lived in this apartment
building," really?
Which is in the background.
My wife could have lived there. Yeah. Is that Trump Village, I think?
No, that's further out. Somewhere. Out, yeah. But
Lester looks like he's having a lot of fun there.
He looks very confident and uncomfortable at the same time.
That's true.
And yeah, he was a great character.
Was he a good friend of yours?
No, we weren't super close, but you know, we dealt with him.
Was he covering you at this point?
This was an outtake from one of the Fumettis from the punk magazine.
Oh, right.
Things.
Right.
This was from that moment. And this girl was in a band called the Slander Band. And
she's Jessie Blue.
Jessie Blue, right. She's gone.
And I love that the girl in the bikini is Frankie the Shark Woman.
Yeah, Legs McNeil said he went out with her, but that was only, the only information I could get was Frankie the Shark Woman.
Yeah. It's a great photograph. And I love the little boys.
Yeah, those are the civilians.
Camera. Yeah, no, they're terrific. And then, of course, I have to ask you about the whole William Burroughs connection as well.
Well, I'm sure we met Burroughs through Victor Bokris, who we did an earlier book with. He's a writer and, you know, man about town. And he was, you know,
he's a biographer.
He does a lot. And I think he's down here. I think he lives in Florida.
Does he now live in Florida?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And he, you know, there's a period when he was hooking everybody up with Burroughs and bringing Jagger and this one and that one to meet him. And
did you go out to Kansas to meet him?
No, we first met him in New York and in the bunker. And then later when we were on tour, we went to see him at what was called the Stone House, which was this old mill sort of place that he lived in. And then later I went and stayed with him in Lawrence and in town more.
You have these great photographs of his bookshelf and of his typewriter, which really appeals to me as well.
I am very thankful I got to hang out with him.
Yeah. What was your impression of him?
He was just a sweet guy.
Yeah.
You know, he was super down to earth. And he was friends with all the neighbors on his block and who were just really normal, average people. And they just all, you know, there wasn't much of a, there was no conflict. He was just considered, they knew who he was, but he fit in.
Yeah. Well, that whole period, that whole group of of Burroughs and Ginsberg, who I guess was still in New York at the time.
Yeah, I met him a couple of times. I met Brian Geisen once. Debbie knew a couple of those guys. She knew Corso.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I once saw this amazing reading with Ginsberg and Corso where they were doing dueling poems.
Yeah, rap battle, early rap battle. Really, nice.
Really, really great. But, and these photographs of Debbie, I mean, I think your work has created these iconic images of her in so many ways. When did you start photographing her? Was it a conscious decision?
She was just very striking. No, I mean, she was just so gorgeous. It was, you know, wasn't kind of a no-brainer thing. You know, people saw a lot of these images in some of the rap magazines before they heard the music even.
Yeah, I love this. You have one of a real close-up of her on the streets of New York with an old, looks like a Pontiac in the background there. It's really a beautiful photograph. Most of this book is in black and white. Do you like working more in black and white than color?
My Instagram is all black and white for cohesiveness at this point. I mean, unless I frequently will change a color shot into black and white just so it's kind of fits in a little better. But I shot at least, you know, maybe a quarter color back in those days.
And this is your second book of photographs, right?
I think there's more color in the first one.
Rizzoli did an original
one. First one earlier. Is a little more flamboyant and has all the music people in it.
But the other thing that I really love about this is your voice, the voice that you write throughout it. And there's something at the end that really struck me. I mean, it goes to a little bit about what we were talking about. It's the afterword, but you express a little bit about the New York of today and what 9/11 meant. Would you mind reading a little bit of it?
I can't remember it.
Here, it's right here. The whole thing. If you could just read the afterword, I would love that.
Oh, Barbara and I got married in 1999 and moved into my loft on Greenwich Street in Tribeca. In September 2001, we had just returned from our second trip to Burning Man. We'd been back for about 5 days. Barbara had this big old dog, and I had just come back from walking him around the block in the morning. There was always the sound of planes, but I heard a really loud airplane engine followed by a muffled boom. It's a true story. Within a few minutes, the phone started ringing. Turn on the TV. We went out to the street and saw the huge hole in the North Tower. The whole event was unreal and surreal. That's that. I'll skip a little. Before the attacks, a lot of weird stuff happened around where I lived on Greenwich Street. Also true. For a couple of days, several blocks had been shut down to traffic, and guys in hazmat suits had swarmed around doing some sort of drill or reenactment. I think that was related to the first bombing. You know, right. There was a lot of response to that. I heard reports from the people in the neighborhood of flashlights shown at the skylights on top floors, police activity on roofs, etc. So the press setting up tents and the National Guard making us show our ID to get home didn't seem particularly odd. What else do I have to say here? It was about a year of very communal feelings of togetherness in the city afterward. And then, as if a switch was pulled, New York City began its ascent or descent to becoming the almost final form of a vast corporate world center. Okay. Yeah. I still like it in New York City. I tried living away in the country for a bunch of years. We came back to the city. Back in the 60s and 70s, I had no idea that I'd come to miss the decay and the danger. Yeah, all that stuff.
Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, it's all, you know, I mean, if I could time travel, I would like to see what the 20s were like in the city, you know. Except I don't know what kind of job I could get.
in the 20s in New York, you'd probably
be a bartender or something.
Yeah, you probably have, but you might also be a photographer again. Or
yeah, I'm a big Ouija fan. Yeah, but he's a little later too, but still.
Yeah, but or you maybe it opened sort of a great little bookshop there.
Yeah, something. Who knows?
So photographer or guitarist, or do you not make that choice?
Yeah, no, it's just a certain movements of the same piece.
And tell me, with Face It, what did Debbie get so right and face it?
Just the tone, I think, you know, it's a lot of stuff. I have to keep reading it. I gotta read it again. I mostly just skimmed the draft initially. I have to sit down and go through the whole thing. But people seem to be reacting positively to it, so that's a nice.
Well, they are. We have a, it's gratifying. a full house tonight, and but you know, your relationship is on so many different levels. I mean, you guys, you know, were, you know, living as a couple, then you continued to work together even after you sort of broke up that way. What were the challenges to that?
Oh, I don't know that there were a hell of a lot. There wasn't any animosity or anything. It just happened, you know. The relationship sort of whatever ran its course. And,
but we all know that.
Yeah, well, we just continued. We're still at it, you know. I've been married now for 20 years and have two teenage daughters, so I deal with that.
And what are they into? What are your daughters into?
The little one is kind of does a lot of graphics. The older one is into boyfriend drama. So, yeah.
And do you live in the city?
Yeah, right, we live now in Manhattan, yeah.
And so they're in school, they're in high school?
They're in school in the city, yeah.
Do you have any real relationship to Miami? Have you spent much time here?
No, not a hell of a lot. I've been in London the most, in LA more than here.
Is there a part of the world that you'd like to photograph or some scene that's going on?
Yeah, sure, in plenty the world. Of stuff. Yeah, whatever, going to Ukraine, whatever the hell.
Well, there, that's.
But, you know, but. It's different, you know. It's getting to me. I'm 70 and all this stuff, getting around.
You're 70.
You look in January. I'm holding up. January 70. I'm still
you
sitting.
You look terrific.
Technically 69, which my daughter thinks is the funniest thing in the world.
Yeah, I know. Well, someone once said that, you know, you have kids and you don't realize that you have kids to mock you. Basically,
yeah.
Their youth mocks you all the time.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're good for that. The little one looks like me when I was younger too, so it's a whole thing.
What kind of music are you listening to these days?
Everything, anything.
Is there anything new that's really?
Yeah, I mean, I really like Billie Eilish.
Yeah,
and you know, I love Beirut, and there's a great. There's still a lot of people maintaining the punk aesthetic. There's a band called Surfboard out of New York who are really entertaining. Amel and the Sniffers and Sunflower Bean and Black Lips. There's a lot of great bands going all the time, you know.
But your interest is in everything, pretty much.
Yeah, sure. I love it. Yeah, and you know, some of the big hits of the last 10 years are just some of my favorite pop songs of all time, like that Major Lazer song, you know, Lean On.
Right.
I mean, it's so good, you know, or Titanium or something like that. I mean, that stuff is as good as anything from the classic rock days.
And we talked a little bit about, you know, the internet and what that's done and the connectivity. What do you think that's done for music in a sense?
For music?
Or for art even?
Well, it's a little different for graphic art and photography. I think Instagram is great. People get to, you know, put their stuff out there and get an audience. Music, it is, you know, I mean, the music scene has changed so much as a result of the internet. Everything is reversed. You know, you used to go on
tour to sell
albums. To sell the album, and now it's vice versa. Right. So all that kind of stuff. And now, you know, I mean, albums aren't even really viable anymore. Everybody just puts out one song at a time. And if it sticks to the wall, then it's there. Otherwise, go on. That kind of stuff.
Are you into sound? Do you listen to stuff analog or the turntable?
No, I don't care. Everything.
Whatever, no, however.
Yeah, I just shoot digital photography. And I don't ascribe to the warmer sound.
So who are some of the photographers that you particularly love and
now
that were now and then also were influenced?
Oh, well, the usual suspects, you know, Arbus. Actually, my buddy McGuire, who I mentioned, was apprenticed for Diane Arbus briefly. Oh. And, you know, Brassai and Bresson and Ouija. I'm a really big Ouija fan. Mary Ellen Mark and Dennis Stock and you know, and we just lost Robert Frank, yeah, and all you know,
Gary Winogrand.
Winogrand, yeah, all the usual, all those guys. Usual suspects.
Right, right. And most of those were black and white.
Well, yeah, it's just easier. It was easier always to, especially, you know, if you were, I never developed my own film. I would always send it out, but still it was faster turnaround with black and white.
You could just do it that way. So today, who are the photographers you look for?
There's one guy on Instagram who I just think is the greatest. His name is Clay Benskin, B-E-N-S-K-I-N.
Clay Benskin.
Yeah, and I've hung out with him a few times, and he's like Brazil. He's just of the street photographers. Wow. He's this big guy, and he just stays invisible, and nobody knows he's taking their picture. And there's other guys on Instagram, but they're all there. If you look at my
look at your Instagram
stuff, you can find. Link up. Yeah, you can see links.
Oh, well, I'm definitely going to do that. That's terrific. What about some of the, you know, some of the crossover kinds of photographers, people who are, it's photography as quote art.
Oh, like Roger Ballin.
Yeah, Roger Ballin.
Roger Ballin's great. Or, yeah, Witkin.
Witkin.
Yeah, no, I like all that stuff. Cindy's great. We, you know, we met her, and she's a charming person.
Nan Golden.
Nan, I know. I just saw her recently. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's where there's been a big shift as well in photography.
Yeah.
There's a great documentary that I'm going to recommend to you. It's called The Last Resort, and it operates on two levels. It's a documentary about old Miami Beach and the old people who lived on. Growing up where you grew up, you'll feel very much at home, even though it's Miami Beach. But it also details the lives of these two photographers who photographed all of these older people. One was working in black and white, and one was working in color. And so it has this kind of strange kind of dual thing. And you can find it online on Netflix or somewhere called The Last Resort.
Last Resort, okay. Well,
and it's Andy Sweet and Gary Monroe, two really great photographers. And I love the fact that it keeps your Twitter keeps beeping along. I want all of Chris's Twitter followers to make sure they listen to The Literary Life. And they find out what's happening here. And we're thrilled to have you at the Miami Book Fair.
Thanks. It's so nice to be here.
Thanks for being here. Okay. And thanks for all that you've done for all of us.
We try harder.
All these years.